Just a quick warning that we're going to be talking about flying, falling, death, photography, light to heavy religious themes expounded upon by people whose education on the matter is lightly to heavily based on Wikipedia articles, existentialism, illusions, nihilism, and oneness. So if you're not in the right headspace for that, just maybe skip these next few episodes. My name is Nikki. Sam is with us for this episode too, just not with me right now for the intro, but she's here. And this is part 4 of A Pin Light Bent. So I hope you guys enjoy it. We'll be back next week with part 5, which I think will be the final part on A Pin Light Bent. And then we're going to cover time as a symptom, which I already am freaking out about. I have very big feelings about that song. So yeah, if you guys want to send your thoughts and theories about time as a symptom, I would be so appreciative of that because it is a gargantuan task to try to disentangle the many layers of that song. So we would appreciate your help. Okay, that's it for now. I hope you guys enjoy part 4 of A Pin Light Bent, and we'll see you next week. By the description of it as a defense. So that word throws me for a loop because it positions the great light then as being a threat, right? It provides scant defense from the great light that shines through a pinhole. And so that means that we are in a position where we feel like we need to defend ourselves from the great light. But like, why do we think the great light is scary? What is it that's threatening about the great light?
What is the great light?
Yeah, that's a great question. What is the great light? I take it to be like oneness, kind of.
But oneness as in death?
Okay, maybe this is a good time to pause and get into what some other people have to say. So we have Lise.
Mm-hmm.
Who we sure do love and appreciate. So we have much. Some Wikipedia stuff about religion and their concept of oneness and illusion of selfhood, which might help inform this conversation. So let's just take a break in our conversation, Sam, and just switch to deferring to other people, if that's okay with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you want to start with the amazing, incredible, fabulous Lise that sent us a super informative and insightful voice memo?
Mm-hmm. So Lise is going to talk a little bit about photography and the pinhole as existence, the pin light as part of the universal cosmic light that we are maybe perceiving or reflecting or projecting, but I'll let her explain it.
Yeah, so here is Lise. We will be back after her voice memo to discuss what she says.
Hi, Sam and Nikki. It's Lise. I wanted to drop you guys a voice memo about photography on divers. I think there are several references to photography on this album. I also noticed that there are many more references to modernity and technology than on any of her other albums, and I think those things are all related, and maybe I'll get into that on maybe a later voice memo, because this could just go off the rails. So I'll stick to photography for now. I know you guys are talking about A Pin Light Bent this week, so I wanted to talk about the reference to camera obscura on that song. I think it's really interesting that she references that specifically. So the camera obscura is a natural phenomenon that apparently was first noticed in around 800 BC in a cave. So this is a phenomenon where in a small hole in an otherwise darkened space projects an inverted image onto the wall of what is outside of that space. So obviously this was instrumental in the development of photography as well, along with the chemistry that allows us to fix images. So I feel like in general on this album, these photo references relate to the themes on the album about recording things, fixing things, trying to arrest time or memories and not let things slip away, but also the ultimate futility and impermanence of everything, even with those efforts. And I think that's why I'm so fascinated by photography and why, for me, it has this like melancholy and nostalgic and ghostly pull. And in photo theory, we find essays about this as well, about ghostliness, melancholy, and death. Bart writes about this, and people who reference him always come back to this sort of paradox of trying to arrest images within a continuous flow of time. And the image, say, of a person who's going to die, and you look at that and you're like, they were alive then, they're dead now, but in the image, we're looking back to like a past present that's looking toward a future where they know they will no longer be here and someone might be looking at it after they're gone. So there's a kind of spooky sadness to that. I guess back to Pinlight Bent, I feel like the camera obscura in reference is interesting because it implies a photographic image that isn't fixed. So it's simply experienced as a sort of projection of what's occurring outside of one's own space. So I kind of feel like she's talking about the pinhole as our existence. It's a specific time and place. It's sort of see the pinhole as coordinates in space. And then if she says the pin light is selfhood, I guess I feel like that's the part of the universe, or the universal or some kind of cosmic light situation that we are perceiving and maybe even reflecting or projecting, or is being projected within the space that we can see. So I guess I kind of see this reference as being very much about perspective, but light being very much about a kind of like greater cosmic energy that's too big for us to perceive. And we just kind of have our own piece of it, or our own limited view that it reflects reality the way photography does. It is a recording in a very different way than, say, a drawing is, but it still is distorted through a specific lens, right? One last thing. I also thought of the allegory of the cave. I thought that could also be an interesting thing to reference, maybe with your philosophy background, Nikki. And I guess anything else, I'm going to leave for another voice memo. Okay. Love you guys. Bye.
Lise, you're incredible. Okay. So Lise was talking a lot about the end of the verse here. So the camera obscura, which I didn't realize was so old, 800 BC in a cave.
That blew my fucking mind. 800 BC was like our proto camera. So I think Lise describes this in her voice memo, but just because I'm somebody who needs this concept repeated to me because it's super confusing to my brain, a camera obscura is it can be a natural phenomenon or it can be a constructed thing, but essentially its basic form is just a picture yourself like in a room. One wall of that room has a tiny little hole. Sometimes there's a lens in that hole, but I think sometimes you can just have the right kind of hole. And through that hole, an image gets projected onto a surface outside of that room. And not just any image, but the image of everything behind that wall. So of the room. I don't know if that made anything clear. What was interesting to me is that sometimes the lens, if there is a lens in the camera obscura in question, the lens will distort everything. So in that it'll make everything upside down and also reflect it, like mirror it. I don't know how to describe that, mm-hmm. that change in perspective.
Like identical but opposite?
Yeah, exactly. Identical but opposite and upside down. So
yes.
I don't know if that helped anybody, but that's the basic image of a camera obscura, the basic idea of it. And so, yeah, the idea that it's fucking 800 BC, is it blows my mind.
My favorite camera obscura fact is just from the Wikipedia page. And it's that the human eye and those of animals such as birds, fish, reptiles, etc. works much like a camera obscura with an opening pupil, a convex lens, and a surface where the image is formed in the retina. So I like that because we're talking so much about perspective and the idea that our own perspective is obscured or mirrored or distorted in some way. Really sticks. I really like that.
I fucking love that. When I read that on the Wikipedia, I lost my mind.
Yeah, I love that we're both there too. Yeah. Yeah,
100%. Like that we have this distortion built in, like that's our own eyes are doing that to us, are deceiving us in that way. And like by deceiving, I mean like because of the like flipping and fucking with the image. But yeah, I, like fact of the podcast, I loved that, and it speaks to, I think, the distortion that we've been talking about throughout this episode.
Okay, I love also, just let me scroll back to my Lee's notes. Where are they? I love that Lee's talked a little bit about photography and like image reflection and mirroring as specifically photography as nostalgia. She said something about how like how crazy it is to take a picture of someone and have them exist in that photograph, but not have them exist in their human form. And with that comes like a lot of melancholy and ghostliness, which is just like a fantastic word.
I love that. She was saying mm-hmm. that like people in the literature like talk about photography in that way as like mm-hmm. nostalgia and ghostliness and the idea of just impermanence, right? Like mm-hmm. it's built right into photography that we're trying to like stop time through this capturing of an image, as Lee's was saying.
And like, this song is so much about impermanence. Like if we're posing this song as the narration of someone as they fall to their death, like what's more impermanent than that?
It's like impermanence blown up right in your face.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unavoidable.
Yeah. And I also just love the idea that impermanence is so closely related to Hinduism and Buddhism, which are huge proponents of the tenets of oneness and non-separateness, which we'll get into in a bit after we're done with some of the stuff that Lee says. So I thought that was super interesting that like the foundations of photography and the basic principles upon which they rely and explicitly bringing up the idea of a camera obscura is just sort of giving a shout out to that idea of impermanence. And I think that, yeah, it just feeds nicely into some of the themes that are going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And also that it's inherently melancholic. Like mm-hmm. Lee's talked about the melancholy involved in just the idea of trying to, of capturing a moment in time. I really love that. And again, as it relates to Buddhist and some thoughts in Hinduism, that like it's suffering to try to cling to, like suffering is trying to cling to these moments in time because they're impermanent, right? And so that brings about, that's the cause of a ton of human suffering. Yeah, I just love that.
Yeah, I love that too.
Okay, so do you have more to say on Lise's voice memo?
I don't think so, other than thank you so much, Lise. We so appreciate you.
We so appreciate you. I loved, especially your perspective, your informative and insightful perspective on photography, because I know that you know a lot about it. So we just really appreciate you taking the time to send us a voice memo. Thank you so much.
Oh, sorry. Lise also followed up with a brief email.
Oh.
She said, also, I forgot to mention that a camera obscura is also an object that was used for drawing, etc. At some point between the cave and the invention of the camera, that's where the mirror reference makes the most sense. I guess since she mentions a mirror, Joanna was picturing the old object slash box, but in the broadest sense, camera obscura refers to the phenomenon in any form.
Right.
And then she mentions an artist named Zoe Leonard who makes camera obscura installations for contemporary art museums.
Ooh.
I don't know if you ever did this in elementary school. One of my favorite like art time things was like, it was like a clear plastic reflective tool that you would like put over half of a drawing so that it reflected the other side and you could like,
oh, I don't even know what that it sounds was. Just like a camera obscura. I think that's what it is.
Children's art mirror reflector.
Hmm.
I remember loving those because you could clearly like trace. I remember doing like a butterfly and you could like trace the other side of the butterfly really cleanly.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Reflector geo mirror.
Okay. Okay, so in her voice memo, Lise had mentioned Plato's cave. And so I'll just briefly explain the idea behind Plato's cave in case people are curious. So I refreshed my memory here by just going to Wikipedia, and the introduction paragraph describes it better than or more succinctly than I will. So I'll just read that. So in the allegory, the cave, Plato describes a group of people who have lived chained to the wall of a cave all their lives, facing a blank wall. The people watch shadows projected onto the wall from objects passing in front of a fire behind them and give names to those shadows. So basically just picture like a group of people who are sitting on chairs facing a wall. Behind them, unbeknownst to them, there's like a fire or a source of light. And behind the fire, or sorry, in front of the fire, I guess, you're... different objects pass by. So they see just the shadow reflection, or not reflections. They just see they just see the shadow projections of the objects that pass in front of the fire. And because they spend their whole lives and have lived their whole lives just facing this blank wall, they think that the shadows represent reality, that they're accurate representations of the real world. They're totally ignorant of the fact that like there are real things that are causing these shadows. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So they never get to see, like if it's a person walking in front of the fire, they see the shadow of a person and they're like, yeah, here, look, I can point to that and say, look, person. And look, mm-hmm. I know it's true essence because I've seen this throughout my whole life. But unbeknownst to them, like, oh my god, there's so much more to a person than just this like shadow of it. And so
right. The
idea, the reason Plato is like introducing this in the Republic is because the thought is supposed to be that philosophers, this is not egotistical of him at all, philosophers alone get to know the true nature of the things that are causing the shadows by way of like reason and reflection and logic. And so anyways, the idea is just that there's this whole reality that exists unbeknownst to a bunch of observers. So the shadows represent the fragment of reality that we can normally perceive through our senses, while the objects as they actually are represent the true forms of the objects that we can only perceive through reason, according to Plato and Socrates. Do you know that we never, that Socrates never wrote anything, that we only know about Socrates via the writings of other philosophers, primarily Plato?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Fun fact.
Fun fact. Okay, so I agree with Lise that that is relevant here, that, again, we're getting, like, these distorted perspectives, and that, like, this allusion to the fact that we're all living our lives thinking that we're perceiving the way that things actually are while being completely ignorant of, like, what's just behind us. And I think that in Joanna's analogy, what's just behind us is the great light, the oneness, the true reality of things that we are just unable to see. And regardless of whether we're right that it's oneness that she's talking about, I think that there really is something to the idea that there's something true to reality, the true nature of reality that we're just totally ignorant of, that's just behind us.
I knew nothing about this before. Thank you for explaining it. I'm like looking at the pictures on the Wikipedia as you explain too.
Yeah.
And it does make me think of the camera obscura as drawings too, because at least in this first image on the Allegory of the Cave Wikipedia, the images that are being like projected on the wall can be real things or they cannot be. Like, the people are looking at the wall and they're seeing a projected image of a horse and a projected image of the dog. But what's actually being projected are like statues or man-made representations of those things. So that changes their perspective too, right? It's not an actual, like, then the movements would be really distorted as well. Like, it's showing people carrying like a statue of a horse on a stick. And so it would be like, bum, 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 bum. But that's not how a horse actually moves. So to see a horse in real life after that, you'd be like, the fuck, what is this galloping? What is happening here?
Like, it's very easy to trick the people, the people who are facing the wall, right? It's very easy to get confused about the true nature of things, exactly, because you could have a cardboard image, a cardboard cutout of a horse and hold it up on a popsicle stick. And for all those people know that is what a horse is, but it's not. Yeah, so it's just this very limited perspective, this ability to fuck with the perspective and the true nature of something lying just beyond our reach. We get just like a taste of it, which is such a tease. Like, wow, reality, what a tease that you gave to human nature.
And then it makes me feel like the descent of our narrator here does get like a little taste of that real perspective.
Yes.
If only very brief. Well, only very briefly.
Yeah. Which is so interesting because, like, what is... So if we're positioning this like realization about like the pinhole stuff as being a realization of our flight attendant, which I think is a plausible way to go, then like what is Joanna saying? She's like, if you're faced with this immediate impending death maybe, and you have like a second to reflect on it, and you're like, you know, you have to have this sort of zoomed out perspective given that you're falling from the sky in this particular situation, that like weirdly and counterintuitively, like it becomes accessible to us. Like, but under what conditions, I guess, is the question I'm trying to ask. Like, what is she saying is the impetus for us being able to see things as they truly are? Death?
Mm-hmm. I think death would be included in that category.
I mean, she might agree with Plato here. She might think that, like, just being reflective on it is the only way of accessing the true nature of it.
Mm-hmm. But then the question would be, what forces that like, focused reflection?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Fucking terror death? About life? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, terror about death, existentialism, like searching for the meaning in everything, maybe... Maybe even it just depends on like the person's personality, right? Like you could have like an especially reflective person who you know, flies in an airplane or something and all these thoughts occur to her. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it seems like for our narrator, this brush with death, this immediate, not brush, this experience of doom is something that triggers that.
Yeah, definitely. Which is so sad too, that like at the very last moments of your life, you get this deeper understanding that is sort of designed to be inaccessible to humans as they're living, which is also interesting.
okay, so I did some research just because I knew that we're going to be talking about oneness. And I was like, listen, I can already hear myself being unable to explain this, like the concept that we're talking about. And so I did just a little bit of research into the history of the thought of oneness, of the concept of oneness, and also some psychology on the concept of oneness. So let me just start with the psychology stuff, because I think that I'm more comfortable explaining it. So we'll start there. So this is from an article by Scott Barry Kaufman in the Scientific American. And he references a couple studies that were done by Kate Diebels and Mark Leary. And okay, here's some interesting facts about beliefs, people's beliefs about oneness. Okay, so they found that 20.3% of participants had thought about the oneness of all things often or many times. 20.3%.
That's higher than I would think.
Me too. While 25.9% of people seldom thought about the oneness of all things, and 12.5% of people never had thought about it. So yeah, more than I thought. I think a lot of this depends on who they did the studies on, and I didn't take the time to go look into this. I'm not sure if it's just Western participants or also a broader category of subjects that they did the research on. But regardless, 20.3% is a lot. More than I would have thought.
Mm-hmm. No, me too. And maybe that's just because I assume that it's not something people think of, but that's pretty good.
Not bad. Okay. The researchers also created a 6-item belief in oneness scale consisting of the following items. So here's, like, I wanted to read this just because it's like, I wanted to read this just because it's a list of like different things that we might mean when we're talking about oneness. So, okay, claim one that we might believe. Beyond surface appearances, everything is fundamentally one. Claim two. Although many seemingly separate things exist, they are all part of the same whole. Claim three. At the most basic level of reality, everything is one. Claim four. The separation among individual things is an illusion. In reality, everything is one. Claim five. Everything is composed of the same basic substance, whether one thinks of it as spirit, consciousness, quantum processes, or whatever. Claim six. The same basic essence permeates everything that exists. So some people believe in some of those claims, but not others. Some people believe in all of them, but you don't necessarily need to believe in all of them to believe in one of them. And so The researchers found that those who scored higher on the scale, so that is those who believe more of those claims, were much more likely to have an identity that extends beyond the individual to encompass wider aspects of humankind, life, nature, and even the cosmos. So that might be an obvious finding, because if you believe in oneness, you're probably going to think of yourself as being less distinct from everything else. But Here's some research that proves that. Okay, and then in a different study that these same researchers did, they looked at values and the self views that might be related to belief in oneness. Mm-hmm. And they found that a belief in oneness was related to values, indicating a universal concern for the welfare of other people, as well as a greater compassion for other people. A belief in oneness was also associated with feeling connected to others through a recognition of our common humanity, common problems, and common imperfections. So again, probably unsurprising findings, but I just love the specific laying out of like, look, you're going to be a nicer, more empathetic, compassionate person if you just sort of reflect on these things. The more of those oneness claims that you believe, the more kind you'll be. And I thought that was worth bringing up given what I take to be one of the theses of this album about love and how that might not just be relegated to romantic love, but like love and kindness for everybody. That is sort of a natural extension of belief in this oneness.
Yeah. And that's what it boils down to, I think, makes a lot of sense with not only this album, but with all of her albums.
Or at least
I
like.
I love that. I want to do that study. I want to be a participant in that study. I don't know where I fall.
Yeah. And so, okay, let's just see here. I'd also, interestingly, like in the same vein, when I was looking up the history of Camera Obscura on Wikipedia, I saw that the earliest written observation of the Camera Obscura is found in the Chinese text called Mozi, dated back to the 4th century BC. That text is traditionally ascribed to and named for Mozi, a person who was a Chinese philosopher and founder of Moist School of Logic. And so just like on a whim, I clicked the link for Moism. And Moism was an ancient Chinese philosophy of ethics and logic. And one of its major ethical tenets were altruism and a universal, unbiased respect and concern for all people, regardless of relations or affiliations. So I don't necessarily think she was referencing that, but I just loved that like synchronicity there, that it comes back to this like oneness and concern and compassion for everybody.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that.
Okay, and then just really quickly, a little bit of history on just the philosophy / theology of oneness. So like in philosophy, existence monism is what oneness is called, and it posits that there is only one single thing, the universe, which can only be artificially and arbitrarily divided into many things. But this thought dates back to Buddhist thought. In Buddhism, there's this doctrine of non-self, which holds that no unchanging permanent self or essence can be found in any phenomenon. I just wanted to credit this because this is not like a thought unique to Joanna by any stretch of the imagination, nor is it a thought unique to like Plato. It has deep roots in Eastern philosophy and thought. And then... I don't know. It's obviously very confusing because there's just a ton of scholarly research that I don't know in terms of Buddhist and Eastern philosophy. But one of the things I read was that in Buddhism, the non-self doctrine is often interpreted as a doctrine denying the existence of a self, but that's not entirely accurate. So more accurately, the tenet is that the idea of non-self is a strategy to attain non-attachment by recognizing everything as impermanent whilst staying silent on the ultimate existence of an unchanging essence. So it's, from my understanding, this Wikipedia post or paragraph is saying that like it's not exactly the positing of oneness. It's rather just like, look, this is a strategy that humans can get to be unattached and to deal with the impermanence and the suffering that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was reading that sort of a like an offshoot / a like give and take sort of relationship comes with this doctrine in Hinduism, and forgive my pronunciation here, but it's called Advaita Vedanta. And it is a kind of non-dualism. So the rejecting of not only binaries, but of there being distinct entities, refers to the idea that our experiences of the world and of ourselves are just illusions. In this view, the experiencing self is ultimately the same as all of reality. The individual self is a mere reflection or limitation of a singular reality in a multitude of apparent individual bodies. The idea is that, the idea that there are multiple different individuals is just an illusion. In the Advaita tradition, moksha, so liberation from suffering and rebirth, is attained through recognizing the illusoriness of the phenomenal world and the disidentification of the mind-body complex. By the way, is an orthodox version of Hinduism. So not all Hinduism, I think, follows this tenet. I'm not sure, but, but it was adapted. It adapted, so Advaita Vedanta, this philosophical doctrine, adapted concepts from Buddhism, giving them a Vedantic basis and interpretation, and was influenced by and in turn influenced various traditions and texts of Indian philosophy. So yeah, I just wanted to give credit where credit is due, and also just sort of expound a little bit more upon what we might be talking about in terms of oneness.
Then my next question would be, and I'm not expecting you to have an answer for this at all.
Thank God.
Okay. We have all of these tenets of oneness. We have all of these perspectives. Then my next question would be, and then maybe we can get into this in the next episode, is how that relates to these themes at the end of the verse. And these are things that are capitalized at the end of the verse, which to me makes me wonder about them. So we have great light, we have selfhood, and we have amora obscura.
Yeah, very interesting.
Things that are named, things that are capitalized, selfhood is repeated. So that makes me want to zoom in a little bit more and be like, okay, how does all of that not only connect to oneness, but to our narrator?
Yeah. Great questions. We'll keep them in mind.
Mm-hmm.
One thing of that I thought was really interesting from the Hindu doctrine I was reading, was that moksha, or like liberation from suffering and rebirth, is attained through recognizing the illusoriness of this like selfhood narrative that we give ourselves. So given that this album is so concerned with cycles and cyclical things, and we're talking about reincarnation all the time, and just like if not reincarnation, just like some sort of other cyclical nature that life I don't even know how to form the sentence, but you know what I mean? The cyclicalness has been a huge theme in this album. That if recognizing that this is all an illusion in this tradition is a way of liberating yourself from that cycle, it's positing this cycle as being like a really painful thing, as being something that you need to be liberated from. And I just thought that was interesting in the context of our flight attendant falling and having this realization moments before her death.
Yeah, that she's like only able to face that, to make that realization, because of her circumstances.
Okay, so that does it for now. Thanks for bearing with us with our like religious, half-baked, uninformed discussion. We tried. And we know it's like it's confusing concepts to talk about, to be able to articulate. So if you're here with us, we really appreciate it.
And thank you, Nikki, for doing all of that research. That was fascinating to listen to.
You're very welcome. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/ahopelessendeavor. There will be early-ish episode releases for the next few weeks. And also bonus episodes. So check us out on Patreon. I'll link to it in the show notes. What else do we have? An email, ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com.
We have an Instagram account, which is A Hopeless Endeavor Podcast. We do posting every week there, so come hang out.
And Sam has a super cool, is it Linktree, Sam?
Yes, there's a Linktree, which is great because then you can find all of our episodes, find the Facebook group, and also listen to all of the beats that David has so lovingly created for us.
I fucking love the beat too for A Pin Light Bent. It is, I think, my favorite beat of all time.
It's so good.
So yeah, check that out. Thanks to Sam for making that sweet link tree. We have a Facebook group. You can find us there. I think that's pretty much it. The end,
but not, because we'll be back next week.
See you guys later. Bye.